A cancer diagnosis at any age is certainly life-changing, and today we're going to be talking about its effects on young adults. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our first guest is Suleika Jawad. She's a journalist, advocate, public speaker, cancer survivor. She wrote the Life Interrupted column and is the subject of the accompanying video series in the New York Times, which earned her a 2012 News and Documentary Emmy Award. Suleika was told that she had leukemia at the age of 22, and so we'll talk with her about her experiences, how it changed her life, and certainly inviting your questions, comments, and experiences. Maybe you have questions about cancer in young adults. Maybe you or someone you care for had cancer at a young age. I hope you'll join in the conversation. Just to let you know, we'll also, at along about 11:45 today, have a physician come on to talk about some of the, you know, the specifics of cancer in young adults. So that'll be later on. Right now, we're talking about Suleika Jawad's experiences and certainly inviting you to join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Suleika Jawad, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Hi, I'm so thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us. Tell us about your life before you were diagnosed.
So I think, like a lot of recent graduates, in the summer of 2010, I was feeling pretty excited, but also nervous to enter the real world, as they say in college graduation speeches. And I had dreams of becoming a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, where I had grown up as a kid. But the real world that I found was not exactly the one that I'd been hoping for on a number of levels.
Yeah. And you went, I think right from graduation, you went to France.
I did.
And then symptoms started to appear, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. That's right. But I think, like, for a lot of other people my age, I didn't really make much of the symptoms at first. I mean, youth and health are supposed to go hand in hand. So when I'd get winded walking up a couple of flights of stairs, I'd tell myself that I needed to get back in shape. Or when I was looking quite pale, I told myself that I needed to get some sun. And there's this justification that happens, especially when you have sort of subtle symptoms that gain momentum over a prolonged period of time, which is my experience.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
That the doctors that I saw were quick to, treat my specific symptoms without actually kind of looking at the bigger picture and asking themselves, you know, why is this 22-year-old girl coming in every 2 or 3 weeks with a new flu or virus? And instead they were sending me, you know, home with antibiotics and telling me to rest and treating the individual symptoms as they came up, but not really taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture of what was happening, which, unfortunately, this diagnosis is quite common among young adults, and it can be weeks or months, as the case was with me, before an actual biopsy or scan is performed and the cancer is found.
Yeah, it's had you been 52 or 62 years old, probably would have been a whole different kind of situation in terms of the prognosis and getting help earlier.
That's right.
Yeah.
I did end up actually getting hospitalized for about a week, and the doctors ran every single test except for a bone marrow biopsy, which they didn't feel was necessary for someone of my age. And at the end of that week, I was diagnosed with something called burnout syndrome, which, of course, was not my actual diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But I think it just goes to show how easy it is to kind of overlook different symptoms that young adult patients are presenting with.
I can't imagine. Well, you write about it, and your pieces in the New York Times are great pieces. But your emotional reaction to something like this, what was it like for you?
Well, I think, you know, the name of the column is Life Interrupted, and that's because I think it's what it feels like when you're a young person who gets diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. It's an interruption not only of everything you knew before, but your trajectory going forward. I never returned to France, and overnight when I got that diagnosis, I lost my job, I lost my apartment, and I moved back home into my childhood bedroom in upstate New York. Because I think what's interesting about that age is that, you know, at least in my situation, at 22, I was a year too old for pediatrics, but decades younger than most of the other patients in the adult oncology ward. And while I certainly, had all the markers of being an adult, at the same time, I didn't really have a set career yet. I didn't have a family of my own. I didn't have a lot of things figured out. And so when you throw a cancer diagnosis into the mix, I think it intensifies a lot of those, you know, big existential questions that most 22-year-olds are grappling with as they try to figure out who they are and where they want to be in the world and what they want their lives to look like.
Yeah, for sure. So you were essentially with older people, patients, I should say, people who were typically much older than you and at a different stage of their life, which had to have made it more difficult, as you say.
Yeah, I think, you know, from my first day of being diagnosed, it became clear to me just how much age is a factor in cancer treatment. And that's not to say that it's worse or harder to get diagnosed with cancer at 22 than 52 or 12, but it definitely comes with its own unique set of medical, financial, psychological challenges, among so many other factors. But one of the first indications for me that medicine, maybe more than any adjective, is incredibly personal came late one night when I was Googling the side effects of the chemotherapy I was scheduled to undergo in just a few days. And I noticed infertility as one of the side effects. And this shocked me. And the reason that it shocked me was because no one had mentioned infertility to me as a side effect. Now, at 22, I hadn't really given much thought to the idea of being a mother or children, but I knew in that moment that preserving that possibility was hugely important to me. But it just wasn't something that seemed to be on my doctor's radar. And I think partially because most of the patients that my doctor treated were in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and older. And, you know, something like fertility preservation isn't a big priority, especially when you need life-saving treatment. So that was just my first indication that I was going to kind of need to take an active role in my treatment and that some of my priorities were maybe going to be different to some of their other patients and that I was really going to need to learn to be an advocate for myself.
Yeah. And you were in the kind of the middle of your treatments and you started a column for the New York Times. Talk about how that came about.
Yeah. So, like I said, I graduated wanting to be a foreign correspondent. But when I got sick, and especially when I had to move back home, it just didn't seem possible that I was going to be able to pursue any kind of career, and certainly not one that required me to travel or to interview people, especially since I spent most of that first year in isolation in a hospital room. But I think over those weeks and months of shuttling between my parents' house and the hospital, I not only began to feel isolated, but I think I began to very much lose my sense of self. And I felt like my entire identity had become, you know, subsumed by this label of cancer patient. And so what I did was I started writing in my journal and taking notes on what was happening. And over the course of, just these simple entries that I would write for myself, I slowly started to do a different kind of writing than I had expected to do. And it was a writing that kind of lived in this blurred boundary between journalism and memoir. But what really kind of inspired the column was a talk that I heard by the journalist Amy Goodman. And there was one line in particular from that talk that really stuck with me. And it was this. She said, the job of a journalist is to travel to where the silence is. And I started to think about where the silence was in my own life. And I decided that in my own small way, I wanted to create some kind of platform for a population of patients who are kind of too often overlooked, young adults with cancer. And I took the contents of this journal that I'd been keeping for myself, and I turned it into a very simple blog. What I didn't expect was that within a few days, it would have thousands of views on it, or that an editor from the New York Times would call me up and ask me if I might be interested in writing for them. So that's how it came about. But it was surreal for me because the column launched while I was in the bone marrow transplant unit at Memorial Sloan Kettering, undergoing a very dangerous procedure, but also one that I hoped would be life-saving. And it very much felt like this, you know, lifelong dream come true, but also this other nightmare that I was going through. And the confluence of those two things was pretty surreal.
I would imagine you never thought that your first full-time or your first job would as a writer would be writing for the New York Times.
Never.
Oh, man. It's a wonderful column. Did writing that column help you get through those experiences?
Yeah, I think, of course, certainly. I think that, I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that writing saved me during those weeks and months. I mean, the medicine and the science certainly cured me. But I think that writing allowed me to externalize some of these things that I'd been carrying around kind of silently onto the page. And it was certainly a channel for catharsis. I think it really helped me find my voice, especially at a time in my life when I had to cede so much control of my life to doctors and treatment plans and to these rogue cancer cells that were multiplying in my bone marrow. But I think maybe more importantly, it really brought me community. I'll never forget the day that the column launched. I received an email from a young man who was 19, who also had the same kind of leukemia as me and was in the same hospital awaiting a bone marrow transplant. And I'd never heard from anyone my age with my diagnosis. And we weren't able to meet face-to-face because we were both on isolation status. But just knowing that there was someone else in that building who had been where I'd been brought such a great sense of solidarity and comfort. And those connections and those conversations, whether it's with other patients or advocates or doctors or people who have had their lives interrupted by all kinds of things have truly been one of the things I'm most grateful for that's come out of this entire experience.
I would guess. Saleka Jawad, our guest today, she was diagnosed with leukemia at the age of 22. She's a journalist, a public speaker, and a cancer survivor, talking about her experiences both with cancer and writing about it and the video series, the New York Times, which won her an Emmy in 2012. A fascinating conversation with her, and you can join in too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you've had an experience like this or know someone who has, maybe a question or comment about it. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our producer, Jill Doe, actually our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, talking today with Saleka Jawad, journalist, advocate, public speaker, cancer survivor, talking about her experiences being diagnosed with leukemia at the age of 22. Certainly looking forward to hearing your own comments or questions. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Leica, one of your columns talked about guilt. And it's I would think it'd be hard for some people to understand why would a cancer patient feel guilty?
Well, I think when we talk about interruption, it's not just the patient's life who gets interrupted. There's a ripple effect that moves across an entire family unit, and that was certainly true of my family. My mother had to take about 2 years off of work to be my full-time caregiver. Because of the complexity of my disease, we had no choice but to have to travel to New York City, which is about a six-hour round-trip commute several times a week for me to get the treatment that I needed. What that meant for my family was a number of things, right? There's the loss of income, not just of my own, but of my mother's. There was my father, who was kind of left holding down the fort at home. And then my brother, who was my bone marrow donor, which was fortunate because there's actually only about a 25% chance that a sibling is a match, let alone a good match. And while it was literally life-saving for me that he could be my donor, I think that there's a tremendous amount of responsibility that comes with that kind of role. And I think my brother, who was a senior in college at the time, certainly felt that. And so I think for all of these reasons, and I trust that other people who are living with illness will understand, I felt guilty. I felt guilty about the suffering that was being inflicted on my family. I felt guilty when I would get sick and we'd have to cancel a family trip that everyone had been looking forward to. And of course, my family would have been horrified to hear me say that I felt guilty. But I think that, there can be a real sense of burden that comes with being the person who's sick. But those kinds of tricky emotions were things I really was most excited to write about in the column. I think that there are a lot of aspects of the illness experience that we shy away from when it doesn't fit into that sort of neat survivor's journey. And I was most excited to write about some of the aspects of the illness experience that are kind of too often enshrouded in shame or in silence.
Yeah. And so writing probably helped you handle those feelings.
I think so. I think it's also, you know, really, I mean, you're so limited when you're stuck in bed. But there's actually a long history of artists and writers and thinkers who have been able to create all sorts of incredible things from their bed. We talk about Frida Kahlo, who started painting after a car accident that left her bedridden. Proust and Matisse, who at different points had illnesses and created masterpieces from bed. And I think that, you know, even though I wasn't well enough to have a conventional 9-to-5 job like a lot of my friends, or to travel or to go to parties and all the rest of the big and small milestones, there was something not only cathartic but empowering to be able to carve out a role for myself from bed that wasn't just as a patient, and to find a way to kind of take this trauma that was unfolding in my body and to elevate it into artful expression, into something creative. And that was really exciting to me, and really kind of changed the way that I thought about writing. I started the video series in part because, as someone who'd been sick, I knew how hard it was to read. And I wanted to create visuals. I wanted to have photographs. I wanted to have videos. I wanted to include this kind of multimedia component to reach as many different disability populations as possible. But those are things I would never have been pushed to consider if it weren't for my circumstances.
Yeah. You mentioned your family. You had a boyfriend as well, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, yes. I was very fortunate to have a boyfriend who was really there for me. And, you know, I think that relationships during, you know, any sort of prolonged illness, but certainly a bone marrow transplant, can be incredibly challenging, especially when you're young. My boyfriend and I at the time had been dating for about 2 months before my diagnosis. And something like a cancer diagnosis certainly, adds a whole new element to the already kind of tricky landscape of navigating love and relationships and all that good stuff when you're in your 20s.
Yeah. And he held with you there for, he had to be a help in some way.
Of course. And I think, you know, especially at that age, to be sick can make you feel like a bit of an outcast. So I think having this relationship certainly gave me a sense of normality that would have otherwise been difficult to hold on to. But he was a few years older than me, and I just turned 30. And now that I'm 30, I try to imagine doing even, you know, 10% of what it was that he did for me then. And I truly don't think, I would have had the selflessness to take care of someone in the way that he did.
That's wonderful. Chris, let's take some calls. By the way, you can join in with your own comments at 1-800-642-1234. I want to give a chance for some people to join in. So, Chris in Adams, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Happy, beautiful weather for, what, the 10th day in a row or something? I would just like to thank you for writing your book or writing your articles, and I'm going to read them, because those of us with chronic illnesses at so many places in our lives are made to feel as though we are disposable and not useful, and that we should just crawl in a hole and curl up and die or something, and we're abused and mistreated by so many aspects of the society. And I think it's a great thing that you've taken this on and said that, you know, that we have value. That's all.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Saleika, a comment?
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the chronic illness part of it is so tricky, right? Because we have a capacity to, you know, sit with illness as long as there's a cure in sight. And I think for those of us who have illnesses that are prolonged or chronic or don't have neat cures, like you're right. It's so easy to feel marginalized and overlooked in that. One thing that I take comfort in, and that didn't exist even just 10 years ago, is the incredibly vibrant online and offline communities of people living with chronic illnesses and advocates. And that's something that I felt really heartened by. But thank you for your comments, and I feel for you, and I hear you, and yeah. I stand with you in solidarity.
Thank you again for that call. I appreciate it very much. Well, you know, there are so many things that you have, you know, to go through that treatment. First, you had to be, I mean, your whole immune system had to be killed, basically. So you were... in a situation where you couldn't be, a cold would be almost a terrible, terrible thing, let alone anything else. And that must have been kind of at the age of 23 or so when you went through that part of it, must have been awful.
Yeah, I think, you know, illness is certainly isolating no matter what the state of your immune system is. But in my situation, you know, I wasn't allowed to go in public and out in public. And when I did, I would have to wear a face mask and gloves, which, you know, attracts attention and not always the kind of attention that you want. And so I think certainly for that first year and even in the years after that, there was this level of precaution and vigilance that was just kind of always under the surface. And although I'm very grateful to be cancer-free now, some of that kind of weakened immune system is still an ongoing part of my life, and I have to take precautions that other people my age don't. On a more positive note, there are all kinds of weird, fascinating changes that came with a bone marrow transplant. I have 100% of my brother's DNA. and I joke that if I were to commit a murder for no witnesses, he could be charged for them. I also have all of his childhood allergies. And I've lost all of my childhood allergies. So I used to be allergic to peanut butter, and I now eat peanut butter on an almost daily basis. So there were these kind of lighthearted, just surreal moments during that transplant process that I just found to be so miraculous and fascinating.
Oh, boy. Well, let's take another call. Caitlin in La Crosse, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
So I was kind of wondering, because I know that you went through cancer at such a young age, what similarities have you found between people who are older and kind of going through the same thing? Because I would see from an outside, I would think there would be a lot of differences, but I'm sure there's so many similarities. So could you speak to that a little bit?
Thanks, Caitlin. Yeah.
Thank you, Caitlin. I think the experience of illness and a lot of the themes that we've been talking about, like guilt and isolation or just the frustration of having to be bedridden and not being able to contribute, you know, to the world or to society or to your job or whatever it may be in the way that you had hoped. I think all of that applies no matter how old you are. I think for me, the biggest theme that came up was this uncertainty about the future. That, of course, we all have, but when kind of mortality is in the mix, it heightens that. And I think, you know, it was something that I felt certainly when I was really sick, but it's something that I still think about even now that I'm done with treatment and kind of living my life. There's this, you know, sense of, you know, is the other shoe going to drop, or when is the other shoe going to drop? Is, you know, how long will I stay healthy? Will I stay healthy forever? I think those questions, which we obviously don't know the answers to, can be really difficult to live with. I think, yeah, that applies to patients across the board.
Caitlin, thank you. Anne in northern Wisconsin shot a note to say that she had cancer when she was 2.5 years old, and now she's 82. And
wow.
she wanted to send the message that you can get past it and live a full life. To everybody, don't give up.
I believe it.
I thought that's wonderful. Anne, thank you so much for that. You have 6 strategies for coping with cancer. I want to make sure we get those in a little bit. One was find your community, I believe.
Yeah. I think that to me was the biggest thing. Finding, whether it was, you know, a friend that I made in the waiting room or through a support group. But finding someone who understood what it was that I was going through. That wasn't a friend from before diagnosis or a family member, but someone who had an illness experience and who could understand without, you know, need for qualifications or explanations, what it means to have your life interrupted and to kind of be able to talk about some of those trickier emotions like guilt that come up and to not feel like you have to censor yourself. That was huge for me.
Yeah, I would think. And another was eliminate clutter, which most of us should be doing anyway, I think. But what about that?
So that was, I think I wrote that in the pre-Marie Kondo. I forget what that book is called, The Magical Art of Tidying Up or something to that effect.
Yeah.
But I think the clutter, you know, of course, there's like the material clutter, which whether you're in a hospital room or in your apartment, I think is especially important when you're spending a lot of time in one room or one space. But I think the clutter extended, yeah, to even, you know, people in your life who may not feel like helpful presences during your illness. Because I think if there's any time to, be selective about how you spend your time and what you do with that time, it's certainly during an illness. And I know for me, I had a limited amount of energy each day that I would have to kind of ration throughout the day. And that forced me to be very particular. Not just about my environment, but maybe the people in my environment or the things I was choosing to do with my time.
Yeah, that one of your points was prioritizing your relationships, and I can see where that would have to be a critical aspect as well.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned about being kind to yourself. Be kind to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's hard for all of us.
Yeah.
Whether we have an illness or not. But I know that I put a tremendous amount of pressure on myself when I was sick to be positive and to, speed up my recovery or to this or that. And I, you know, looking back, wish I'd been a little gentler and more understanding with myself. And I wish I'd given myself the space to have a bad day and to feel really upset or grumpy or whatever it was, or to not get so angry with my body when it got sick or when it would do something that, you know, felt like a betrayal. But I found, at least for myself, that I was by far the most kind of harsh and judgmental when it came to how I was coping with my illness.
Yeah. Does it help to do something for someone else? That was one of your other points.
I think so. I think, you know, in a weird way, illness can make you kind of self-centered, right? Because you're focused on managing these symptoms and there's a lot of attention on you when you're sick. And for me, one of the greatest things that I did when I was recovering from my transplant was I adopted a little mutt from the pound. And
Oscar.
It was so hard. Oscar. It was so hard for me to walk this dog and to take care of him when I could barely take care of myself. But it truly was some of the best medicine that I could have given myself. And just having to have the responsibility of taking care of a little creature who didn't care if I was feeling tired or nauseated was really just so important and critical, I think, to kind of getting past everything that I just been through.
Yeah. Well, you're an amazing person, and you are going to be the keynote speaker at the UW Carbone Cancer Center's annual fall conference. It's I'm just going to give some information. It's Friday, October 19th at the Monona Terrace in Madison. You're going to love Madison. The focus of that conference is young adults with cancer. It's open to anybody, open to the public. So I think it's $40 a person, including breakfast and lunch. So you can register online for that. And as you're listening to Saleka speak here, what an opportunity it would be to hear her speak in person. You register online, just go to uwhealth.org/cancerconference. And there's all kinds of things, cancer and sexuality, fertility, genetic testing, helping young survivors, and of course, the chance to hear again Saleka Jawad. It's been a real privilege for me to talk with you today, Saleka. I hope I have a chance to see you at the conference and talk with you again. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It's my honor.
A real pleasure. Saleka Jawad, she is a journalist, advocate, public speaker, and cancer survivor. And she wrote the Life Interrupted column. You can find it and the accompanying video series in the New York Times, earned her a 2012 News and Documentary Emmy Award. Amazing person. And I know you're going to want to hear more and read more about her. And you'd have that chance at that conference coming up for sure. But go online sign up for it. We're going to continue to talk about young adults with cancer. Dr. Ryan Madison is Associate Professor of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Will be talking with us about all types of cancer in young adults, and certainly he's more than willing and happy to answer your questions as well. That's next here on the Ideas Network.